presentation of A Novel Idea on KRCB.org is made possible by our members and by SolarWorks, helping homeowners, businesses, and communities conserve resources and save money for over 21 years. Information on going solar is available at SolarWorks Downtown Sebastopol office, 707-829-8282, or online at solarworksca.com.
Two elderly women sat knitting on that part of the veranda which was screened from the sun by a golden shower creeper. The tough stems were so thick with flower, it was as if the glaring afternoon was dammed against them in a surf of its own light, made visible in the dripping, orange-colored clusters. Inside this colored barrier was a darkened recess, rough mud walls, the outer walls of the house itself, forming two sides, the third consisting of a bench loaded with painted petrol tins which held pink and white geraniums. The sun splashed liberal gold through the foliage over the red cement floor and over the ladies. They had been here since lunchtime and would remain until sunset, talking incessantly, their tongues mercifully let off the leash. They were Mrs. Quest and Mrs. Van Rensburg. And Martha Quest, a girl of 15, sat on the steps in full sunshine, clumsily twisting herself to keep the glare from her book with her own shadow.
That was a reading from Martha Quest, a novel by Doris Lessing. You're listening to A Novel Idea. This is your host, Rosemary Manchester. My guest this evening is Jonah Raskin, professor and chair of communication studies at Sonoma State University. Jonah is the author of several books, including Public Spaces, Private Places, a book of new poems. He also wrote For the Hell of It, The Life and Times of Abby Hoffman. He wrote Natives, Newcomers, Exiles, and Fugitives, Northern California Writers and Their Work. And I believe his most recent work is American Scream, Allen Ginsberg's Howl, and the Making of the Beat Generation. So good to have you back, Jonah.
Yeah, it's great to be here. I love to be on KRCB. It's such a cozy, warm, furry, fuzzy place.
I know. It's really special,
nice,
isn't it?
Fuzzy people, too, here. Or furry people. Or
All kinds. Your a great deal of your writing has been on the Beat Generation, and there's an exhibit in San Francisco of Jack Kerouac.
Have you been? Well, actually, it's at the New York Public Library.
In New York? Oh, my
yes,
gosh.
Yes. So, but if you can't get to New York, there's also a book that's available. It's called, I believe it's called Beatific. It's by Isaac Gewirtz. And it's the best exhibit. The exhibit is the best exhibit that has ever been done any place, any time about Jack Kerouac. And the book is absolutely fantastic. It is the one essential book that people have to have about Jack Kerouac. It has great pictures. It has great illustrations. There is more in this exhibit than I have ever seen before. And there's material. There's a ton of material I have never seen any place anywhere before. It is amazing. It will change. People think they know about Jack Kerouac. This will open everybody's eyes. And I've been emailing experts who say, yes, I didn't realize this about Jack Kerouac.
Can people go on the internet and
you go to Google, go to Jack Kerouac, New York Public Library, and you'll get a lot of information about the exhibit, about the book. Uh-huh. If you're going to New York at all in the next, between now and March, when the exhibit is on until, I say go. It is free, and it's in the New York Public Library, which was one of Jack Kerouac's favorite places in New York, and which is an incredible library. It's probably the library in the whole world, and I've been to lots of libraries all over the world. It's the library that I love the most. It is spectacular.
It is. It's a beautiful place.
Isn't it?
I love the reading room.
Ah,
So if you can't get to New York,
you can get this book by Gewirtz. Yes, Isaac Gewirtz, who's the curator of the New York Public Library, their archives, and they have had these treasures of diaries, notebooks for years, and then they finally have brought it all out.
And you're no stranger here at KRCB. I think the most recent time that that you were on the air was when you played the role of the fire captain in the presentation of the mock trial for Sonoma County's The Big Read.
Book burning, yes.
When we were all reading Fahrenheit 451.
Yes.
I thought you were excellent in that role. You really got into the role
Yes. Well,
you must enjoy being on the stage.
I'm a bit of a ham, if the truth
be
known. Yes. Okay.
Aren't we all?
Yes.
Well, Jonah, you're here tonight to share your thoughts on Doris Lessing and her writing.
Yes. Delighted to be able to do that. I love Doris Lessing. I've known Doris Lessing for about 40 years. I met her in 1969 on the first time she came to the United States, and I saw her last in July in London, and I've continued a friendship with her from all that time, and I've learned so much from her and benefited greatly from her.
How did you come to know her?
Well, she came to the campus where I was teaching. I was teaching English and American literature in the late 60s at the State University of New York at Stony Brook. And she came there to visit. It was her first visit to the United States. She had been trying for years to get to the United States, but the United States, the State Department, would not allow her to come into the United States. She'd written a lot of books. The Golden Notebook had been published. It had gotten acclaim from critics in the United States and all around the world, but she was still not allowed to come into the United States because she had been a member of the Communist Party.
Yes.
In southern Rhodesia, where she grew up, and then after she arrived in England in 1950.
But she had renounced the party long since when she came to the States.
She had left the party, yes, but she didn't go around. She was not one of these people who made a career of being anti-communists.
Uh-huh.
I mean, there were some people, that's all they did. They denounced communists and communism, and they said, I hate communism, and I once believed it, and it betrayed me. She left, but she didn't jump on that bandwagon, and she also continued to admire some people who remained communists. So her whole relationship to communism and the Communist Party is very complex. She detests orthodoxy of any kind, including the orthodoxy in the Communist Party, where you were supposed to follow what was called the party line and parrot what you were told to say. But she used to say, she has said that the most neurotic thing that she ever did in her whole life was to join the Communist Party. I think I know what she means.
Well, she was very young.
Yes, I guess she was young, but she latches hold, or maybe I was going to say she latches hold of different kinds of ideas and isms, but maybe they latch hold of her. She's a very passionate person. So, for example, in the 1980s, she went to Afghanistan and she identified, I believe they were called the Mujahideen, the people who were fighting against the Soviets.
Yes.
I mean, she loved those people and identified with them.
And causes.
And she's also a Sufi.
Yes.
So, and she's a fervent Sufi person, and she takes offense very easily when people, well, even if they just want to talk about her and Sufism. She says the only thing you have to be to be a Sufi is to say, I'm a Sufi, and that's it. There's no big mysterious thing, and there's no doctrine you have to accept, and So even though I've known Doris Lessing for, as I say, about 40 years, I have never really talked to her about Sufis or Sufism, though the first time when I met her, she did give me some books about Sufism.
Was it new to you then?
But I don't think I'd ever heard of Sufis.
Oh. You know. Uh-huh.
Yeah. Mystical branch of Islam. Mm-hmm. So I would say Doris Lessing is also, she finds a lot of value in Islam, but she also knows that after 9/11, there's a lot of suspicion and dislike and hatred, I guess, of Islam and Islamic fundamentalists. And she's thought that mostly the information that people hear about Islam is negative, you know, so she's concerned about that.
Yes. And you brought her here to Sonoma State in, what, 1989?
I didn't actually bring her here.
Ah.
Copperfield's books brought her here.
Oh, I see.
She had a book of short stories, I believe that was called, it had two different titles. You know, it had a title in England and it had a title in the United States. I believe the British, The Real Thing, I believe was the title in the United States.
Yes.
And I think the London, the English title was London Observed. I liked London Observed better because there are stories about London and about London people. And that was a great day that I spent with Doris Lessing. I got to spend a whole day with Doris Lessing. I mean, I've spent part of a morning, part of an evening, part of an afternoon. But that day, I met her in San Francisco at her hotel. We drove around the city. We drove up across the Golden Gate Bridge, up here in Sonoma County and back country roads. And she said that Sonoma County reminded her of parts of Africa. So she had this like instant attachment and kinship with the place, with the hills and the colors of the hills. And we had lunch in Katati, and she'd been taken to gourmet restaurants in San Francisco, and she said, I don't want to eat in another gourmet restaurant. Could we just go to a plain, ordinary place? So we did, and they had really good, right where Redwood Cafe is now, and maybe someday they'll have a plaque that said Doris Lessing had lunch here, you know, because she just won the Nobel Prize for Literature.
Yeah, I wondered if we'd mentioned the Nobel Prize yet. Yes, right.
And she's going to go to Oslo, no, to Stockholm. It's Stockholm, isn't it?
I think so.
To get it, yes. Yeah. So she read in the gymnasium at Sonoma State, and so we had lunch. I took her to her hotel. She got dressed all up, very nice looking, and she wanted to look nice and did look nice. And she asked me to go. She gave me, the London Observed is made up of a collection of stories. She gave me like six or seven stories, and she said, pick out the ones you think I should read.
Oh, my goodness.
So I did. I did pick out, and I gave her the order in which I suggested she read them. And she said, well, I like the ones you've picked out, but I can't read. I don't remember exactly which one I suggested she read first. She said, I can't read that one first because it's humorous. And if I read that one first, people just laugh the whole time. And the other stories are not humorous, so I can't read that one first. I have to read that one at the end.
I didn't know she'd written anything funny. I'll have to get that book.
Yeah, she is mostly a serious writer.
Oh, yes.
So when she came to Stony Brook the first time in 1969, and she came, I was teaching The Golden Notebook in a class on contemporary British literature. I had heard about The Golden Notebook from a really dear college friend of mine named Michael Strong, who'd been an English major and who introduced me to literature and to books and told me about George Orwell and basically taught me how to read, how to be, I mean, I had read books, but I didn't know how to read them as like an English major and how to talk about them.
Right.
So he introduced me to George Orwell. And then when I was teaching this class or about to teach the class on contemporary British literature, I said, Michael, what do you think I should teach? He said, you have to teach The Golden Notebook. Mm-hmm. I said, I've never heard of it. He said, it's by Doris Lessing. It's, mm-hmm. She's a great writer.
Mm-hmm. Not an easy book to teach, I imagine.
No, and it was also, I have my copy here, and it's like, it's over 600 pages. So the students did not want to read a 600-page book.
Right.
So this was also a time when they were reading very short books like Brautigan,
yes.
Trout Fishing in America,
yes.
or Kurt Vonnegut.
Yes.
With a lot of short sentences.
Yes.
And here was Doris Lessing with this book that seemed overwhelming.
Well, it is overwhelming.
And, absolutely. And
yeah.
And they also found it very depressing. And
yes.
so they took her name, one of the students in the class took her name, Doris Lessing,
uh-huh.
and kind of flipped it around and they started calling her Loris Depressing.
Oh, dear. Oh, dear.
But as soon as she came to class and started talking, they just loved her.
Ah.
Well, for one thing, you know, she never graduated from college.
That's right.
She never went to college.
Never went to college, right.
So this was also a time when they were very students, undergraduates. There was a lot of people who were leaving colleges
yes.
and going on the road and going to communes.
Yeah.
The people, they call them dropouts.
Right.
And so they thought of Doris Lessing as a dropout.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
She was about 50 years old at that time.
Mm-hmm.
She was just 50, yes.
Mm-hmm.
But she had done all kinds of, including not going to college. I mean, she'd also tried different kinds of drugs.
Oh.
And could talk about drug experience. So, but she was not an advocate for drugs. She said, well, you can actually learn how to use your mind and you can have the same kind of experiences without drugs if you learn how to control your mind and where it's going and the kinds mm-hmm. of things you think about and you see. So she has this very, well, in those days you would have said like a kind of trippiness about her.
And a wonderful mind.
Incredible.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah. I looked in the archives and found the article of it when she came here to Sonoma State, and there's a lovely mention in there of the two of you taking a walk after the lecture, looking up at the sky, and naming the constellations.
Yes.
I thought that was wonderful because, of course, in Africa, one is so conscious of the sky. And she said that, you know, she missed seeing the Southern Cross when she was here in the Northern Hemisphere. But I love that little snippet of information.
Right, so that was the end. After she read on campus, then there was a reception in the art gallery. And then I don't know why we did it. Maybe it was a warm night.
Mm-hmm.
And we were on campus and we walked around and we looked up at the sky and we said, oh, well, that's the Big Dipper. That's the Little Dipper. That's
Cassiopeia.
Mm-hmm. That was fun. That was a really fun connection to have.
Let's talk a little bit about her life. She was born in Persia. I mean, that's rather noteworthy. Her father was a veteran of the First World War and had lost his leg. And I guess he was sent with a bank to Persia. And that's how she happened to be born there. Her father was working there. And then they came back to London. And almost on a whim, they went to Africa.
Yes.
I found this nice paragraph in some of the research I did. I want to read it.
Great.
Doris was six. And she said about her father, so on an impulse, turning his back forever on England, my father collected all his capital, £800, I think, while my mother packed curtains from Liberty's, clothes from Harrod's, visiting cards, a piano, Persian rugs, a governess, and two small children. That's from A Small Personal Voice. And you wonder where they thought they were going with all this fancy stuff. They ended up in a mud and thatch hut in what was then southern Rhodesia. It's now Zimbabwe. in Mashonaland. She describes it as Lomagundi, gold country, tobacco country, maize country, wild, almost empty. The Africans had been turned off it into reserves. And so there they were in a very isolated place, living in what she called the colonial version of genteel poverty. She describes the house as a cigar-shaped house of thatch and mud, where the piano went out of tune and the Liberty's curtains faded. Isn't that sad? I mean, to think, yes, of the expectations of her mother with all this classy furnishings.
Yes. Yes, her mother, Doris Lessing's, I would say she's still haunted by her parents.
Yes, yes.
Tremendous, yes, influence on her life. Her, yes. When I saw her in London in July, she said that she was writing her last book. She thought it was her last book. Now, she may have changed her mind. Winning the Nobel Prize might influence her and make her decide to keep on writing. But she said she was writing her last novel, and she was imagining what would have happened if her father did not go to Africa, if her parents did not go to Africa, if they had stayed in England and her father had become an English farmer. So here she is, after all these years, still thinking about her parents and still thinking about her father and writing about them.
Now, that's a book I really want to read, an imagining.
Now, apparently that's also very depressing.
And she describes her father. He was dreamy, irascible, hypochondriac, and genuinely ill with diabetes. And her mother, who was a nurse, once again became his nurse, as she had when he was wounded in the war. But think of the isolation in which they lived, Jonah, in this broken-down farmhouse with probably a few servants and maybe miles from any other family. And the only time they saw another family was when they went for the mail and someone else happened to be there at the same time, or when they went into town to shop. So no wonder her parents were such an influence on her, because she had a brother, but she doesn't say much about him, and she was so, growing up in isolation like that.
Well, I think also that the landscape had this really tremendous influence on her.
Oh, yes.
It really saturated her, and I think that my friend Michael Strong introduced me to The Golden Notebook, and when I read it for the first time, I was just totally bowled over by it the first time I read it. I loved the book immediately. Mm-hmm. Before I knew her, before I met her, before I knew anything about her, I liked the book. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that I liked, and I can still remember, the descriptions of African landscapes.
Yes.
Just the sort of vastness of the place.
Yes.
That she's a great writer of landscapes.
Mm-hmm.
Whether they're actual landscapes, like African landscape, or she has this series of books that are set in outer space. She has these landscapes and these distant galaxies that are fantastic, this whole planet in which that freezes over.
Imagined landscapes.
Yes.
Yes.
Just amazing.
Yes. Uh-huh. You know that I lived in Africa from 1958 to 1963, and I remember when I was out there reading Martha Quest, her book, which is semi-autobiographical, at least, and set in Southern Rhodesia, and published in—
You read it in Africa?
I did. And it was published in 1952. I probably read it in 1958, because it hadn't been out that long. We didn't have a lot of cultural amenities, but I did manage to get my hands on books. And that was probably my salvation, as it was hers.
Exactly.
But when she writes about that landscape, and I know Southern Rhodesia fairly well. You know, I've been to the places that she talks about in the books. I've been to the Mashona Hills. And in Martha Quest, the group of young people that she hangs out with are out in the belt. I guess they don't call it the bush in Southern Rhodesia. It's the belt. Mm-hmm. And she talks about the caves with the Bushman paintings.
Yes.
And I've been to those caves and seen those paintings. And I think that was she was so real for me, because while I was a mother of four children, I wasn't like Martha Quest, you know, growing up in this isolation, and we lived in a mining town, not out in the veldt. But I felt a tremendous linkage with her, and it was like I was felt I had a special understanding of that story because of the way she wrote about the relations between the colonialists and the Africans. And I shared her concerns.
So, yes. Well, Rosemary, you belong to the generation of women who read Doris Lessing.
Yes.
Beginning, well, I guess in the 50s, the late 50s, yes. And continuing through the 60s and the yes. 70s. And for mm-hmm. this generation of women, mm-hmm. Doris Lessing was just a very strong and powerful influence.
Oh, yes. She was. But you know, Jonah, I thought I'd read The Golden Notebook. Uh-huh. And I got it out to prepare for our conversation today.
Yeah.
I don't think I ever read it.
Uh-huh.
Because I wouldn't have forgotten it if I had read it. I think I had it confused with the books in the Children of Violence series, the Martha Quest books.
Yeah.
So I've been reading Golden Notebook for the first time, and it's...
Well, what a wonderful experience.
Well, it is, and it's overwhelming. And I read it much too fast. I'll go back and you know, read it more slowly, because I wanted to be ready to talk with you about it today.
What would you say you found overwhelming about it, besides the length of it?
The construct. I felt I needed to draw a chart on the wall. Here is Doris Lessing writing about a woman named Anna Wolfe. And Anna Wolfe keeps journals, which are called the notebooks, the five notebooks. And in the notebooks, Anna Wolfe composes stories about other women and their children. So it's layers and layers and layers. And maybe I was trying to pay too much attention to it. Perhaps I should have just done it like an impressionist painting and just read the book without thinking so much about it. What would you think?
I remember that what I liked about the book when I first read it in 1967 was the way that the book is written.
Ah.
I mean, I liked the fact that there were books within books, that it was fragmentary. Because I'd heard people talk about things like form and content in literature classes.
Yes.
And I don't think that I ever really got what they were talking about until I read The Golden Notebook. Because it seemed to me that the book was about things falling apart or
yes.
things, the lack of any coherence or unity,
mm-hmm.
you know. And so that was what the overt subject was. And it seemed to me that the form of the book mirrored its subject.
Mm-hmm.
So I liked the very beginning of the book is, the point is, said Anna, as her friend came back from the telephone on the landing, the point is that as far as I can see, everything's cracking up. So I love that beginning because... Well, for a lot of reasons, because I just love the idea of these two women, Anna and Molly,
yes.
in London together,
yes.
talking. It seems so British.
Yes.
And it seems so much a part of the tradition of the English novel. It seemed like, well, this is what, if Jane Austen were alive in 1960, that's how she would be writing, these oh. two women who are in this flat together, and they're talking. So I thought this was like, yes, from Jane Austen through George Eliot to Doris Lessing. That seemed like a tradition. I mm-hmm. began to understand what people meant when they talk about literary mm-hmm. traditions. Mm-hmm. I didn't mm-hmm. get it mm-hmm. until I read The Golden Notebook.
Mm-hmm. Well, you have the advantage of your academic training. And, you know, I'm more a dilettante when it comes to books. And so my approach to The Golden Notebook, I didn't have a framework to put it into as you did from your academic studies.
So everything is cracking up. It is about
yes.
this crack up. It's
yes.
about the crack up in the external world,
right.
The Communist Party, the coherence of all that.
Right.
The whole world seems yes. like it's cracking up with this mm. nuclear weapons and yes. nuclear disaster and... Yeah.
And the crack up of the family and all these shattered marriages.
Oh,
and,
yes.
And both Molly and Anna are raising children on their own.
And then the psychological
oh,
crack
yes.
up.
Yes. You know,
so this, to me, this is the great theme of literature in the second half of the 20th century. It is, to me, it is all the great writers mm-hmm. look at crack up.
I yes.
mean, F. Scott Fitzgerald did it right. in poetry. Allen Ginsberg mm-hmm. did it.
And the painters as well, the artists. When I was reading about Doris Lessing, I kept thinking about Picasso because
yes.
he was so formidable and larger than life
yes.
and famous and went from all different styles of painting and invented his own styles. And it seemed like they had something in common.
I love that. That's a great analogy. Yes. I think what's one of the things that they have in common is that they just kept on reinventing themselves. Like mm-hmm. Picasso had a blue period, he had a cubist period, he did have all these different phases. He would do one kind of thing and then he would do another kind of thing. And sometimes people would say, well, you know, Pablo, why don't you just keep doing that kind of art? And he wouldn't do that. Mm-hmm. And Doris Lessing has been the same way.
That's
she's
right.
gone on reinventing mm-hmm. herself.
Yes.
And she's not gone on writing the same kind of novel. She
That's
didn't
right.
go on mm-hmm. writing Martha Quest over
no.
and over again
or
no, no. keep on rewriting The Golden Notebook.
That's right. And they're both going to do what they're going to do. They listen,
so
to,
it takes
listen
guts.
To the inner self, of course.
Because there mm-hmm. are publishers and editors and mm-hmm. agents who say, well, just keep doing that and we can sell
right.
that. And then there's readers who get attached to a certain kind of book.
That's right.
And they say that you meet them at a bookstore and they say, well, Doris, keep on. Why don't you write another book like that? I love that other book.
Right.
So you were talking about Doris and her early years in Rhodesia. And so before we went on further, I did want to mention the two volumes of her autobiography, which I love.
Ah, oh, tell us about
Under My Skin and Walking in the Shade.
Oh.
So they go from her birth in Persia in 1919 all the way up to the publication of The Golden Notebook.
Oh.
And for my money, I guess you could say, they're classics of autobiography. If you want to know how to write autobiography, read Doris Lessing mm-hmm. on this writing about her own life.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that they're as great as The Golden Notebook.
Mm-hmm. And they're all of her books are available. You can get them at the public library, or you can go to the bookstore. If they're not in stock, they'll order them for you. You can buy them on the internet. Some of the books, you know, that we talk about are kind of obscure and hard to find. Doris Lessing is right out there all over the place.
There is a lot of her that is out there. There is some. Mm-hmm. She also has written plays. All of her plays are not available.
Okay.
I only know that because I went in July after visiting with Doris Lessing in London. I went to a conference about Doris Lessing in Leeds. And there were people, mostly women, from all over the world. There were women from India, from North Africa, from China and Japan, from France, who from all these places all over the world who were teaching Doris Lessing. It was just lovely to be with people who... Yes. So, and there was this man who I'd known of for a long time named Paul Schluter. He has ferreted out these plays and poems that Doris Lessing has written, you know. So that's how I know about that.
Well, and that speaks of the universality of her work. She's transcends culture because people all over the world respond to what she presents and what she has to say.
Well, there's wherever English is taught and spoken, which
yes.
is in Canada, Australia, New Zealand, South Africa.
India.
All those places, wherever Doris Lessing is read. And and she's also translated into a lot of different languages.
Yes.
So she was telling me that the Golden Notebook had recently been translated into Chinese.
Oh,
amazing.
Good.
50,000 copies of the Golden Notebook in Chinese. So
amazing.
So I also recommend these two volumes of her autobiography.
Yes.
Walking in the Shade and Under My Skin.
Right.
In which she talks about her life in such just rich detail.
Okay.
At the same time that she's talking about her writing about her life, she talks about what it's like to write about your life.
Yes, so writing about writing, yes.
Mm-hmm. It's a great education in how to write.
Yes.
What's called life writing.
Oh, okay, mm-hmm. I'll get those. Well, let's take a short break. You're listening to A Novel Idea. This is your host, Rosemary Manchester, and my guest is Jonah Raskin of Sonoma State University, and we're discussing the work of Doris Lessing, and we'll be right back. Well, we're back to talk more about Doris Lessing. You're listening to A Novel Idea. This is your host, Rosemary Manchester, and my guest is Jonah Raskin. So far, we've talked quite a bit about Doris Lessing's years in Africa and the novels that she wrote about her life there. You know, I think of her coming to London. She was 30, I believe, when she left Africa and came to London. Brought a son. The things that she left behind, her mother, her father, her brother, two children from one of her marriages. She just picked up stakes and came to London. And she had a novel in her suitcase. The novel is called The Grass is Singing, a murder mystery, really, that she set in the part of Rhodesia where she'd been living. And I want to read a little piece about her becoming a writer. She says, I always knew I would be a writer, but not until I was quite old, 26 or 27, did I realize I'd better stop saying I was going to be a writer and get down to business. I was working in a lawyer's office at the time, and I remember walking in and saying to my boss, I'm giving up my job because I'm going to write a novel. He very properly laughed, and I indignantly walked home and wrote, The Grass is Singing. I'm oversimplifying. I didn't write it as simply as that. But isn't that a great story?
That is Doris. That does say a lot about Doris, yes. So I did want to backtrack just a little bit.
Of course.
Back to southern Rhodesia.
Yes.
And you were talking about reading when you were in Africa. And,
yes.
And you did mention, I believe, Doris's reading there.
Yes.
And so I just wanted to say that she in Africa, she read a lot of Russian literature.
Yes.
She read Tolstoy and she read Dostoevsky.
Mm-hmm.
And they influenced her profoundly. So, I mean, the Russians, she loved Russian literature. And so reading Anna Karenina and War and Peace, you get a sense of like the bigness of the novel, that mm-hmm. the novel is a, shall we call it, a vehicle, like to write about the whole of society, the bigness of that, historical characters and the sweep of it. In the Children of Violence series, I mean, she's aiming and does write about like a whole society.
Yes.
And the setting and different people from different walks of life. And
yes.
So you get a feeling for this whole world.
That's right. And particularly in Children of Violence, it seems that they're living such a frivolous life. This group of young people, some of them are RAF pilots who are training
yep.
in Rhodesia, and then the local people, and they go out drinking and dancing every night and just seem to be almost like the lost generation. And there's not much – I think there's very little seriousness in their lives, and that's probably why the Communist Party seemed like kind of a lark to join that. And so I'm very eager to read her autobiography and compare what she says about her actual life with what she's put into fiction.
Yes, that would be great, because there are RAF pilots – and there is that whole social world in the autobiography, in the first volume of the autobiography.
Yeah. Well, I can hardly wait to get my hands on those. Something else to read.
Yep.
And she was published right away, wasn't she?
Yeah. So I think that also she says there, and you read that passage where she was like, I believe you said 26 years old.
Yes.
That would have been in 1945.
Mm-hmm.
So where she said she was going to be a writer.
Yes.
I don't have all the exact dates of her early writing. She was writing before 1945.
Yes, yes.
She was publishing stories in small magazines in Africa.
That's right. I'd forgotten that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And certainly keeping a journal.
Yes.
And she's been keeping a journal and notebooks all these years.
Mm-hmm.
I asked her once recently about her journals, and she said, "Well, they won't be seen for a long time. I don't want people to see them while I'm alive."
Well, that's so interesting because she's so forthcoming. I mean, she doesn't seem to be holding anything back in her her novels. So you wonder what's in the journals. Well, she certainly she feels that there's some things she wants to keep private.
Well, she can be very cutting. So I would say that my relationship with Doris Lessing, I always felt very maternal. I mean, I felt like she was very motherly.
Mm-hmm.
So sometimes she could be very nurturing, nourishing. I mean, literally feeding me and providing some instruction, I would say. And sometimes if she thought that something I was doing was, in her views, like stupid or dumb, she would just tell me and she would say, "Jonah, that is a stupid thing to do." Just like that. "That was a dumb thing that you did."
She didn't mince words.
No, she didn't. So, and it wasn't only with me. And so, you know, she said to me not long ago also that she had learned that she had actually hurt people's feelings. And so I think in the last 10 or 15 years of her life, she's mellowed out.
Did it surprise her that people were hurt by things she'd said?
I think it probably did.
It's just the way she was.
So, yeah. Rosemary, on the subject of maternal, and you mentioned that she came to London in 1949 with her son.
Yes.
Well, her son Peter,
yes,
10 years ago, her son Peter moved next door to her in London so that he could take care of her as she was aging. And then he had a stroke, and then he had another stroke, and then he developed diabetes. And so now she is taking care of him. At the age of 88, she's a full-time mother. Isn't that amazing?
That is
remarkable.
Amazing. They must be very close.
Yes. When I visited her in London in July, there he was in his pajamas and in her place watching Wimbledon on TV.
Hmm.
The day that she found out that she'd won the Nobel Prize for Literature, she was coming back from the hospital, from visiting him in the hospital. He'd broken his shoulder.
You spoke with her that day. You called her right away?
I called her and talked to her on the phone, and she was really happy.
Oh, yes. I think she might be.
She was really happy.
When she was interviewed that day on television, she was a little brusque.
Absolutely. Very funny, yes.
And very funny, yes.
Well, for years they've been talking about giving her the Nobel Prize.
Yes.
And so if they 10, 12 years.
Yes.
And so it was kind of anticlimactic to finally get it. And she's won a zillion awards.
I was looking at her, a list of awards.
Didn't you look? Yeah, isn't that amazing?
Astonishing, yes. Yes.
All over the world.
And honorary degrees and prizes for her books and for her accomplishments. Yeah, so this isn't the first time she's won a prize.
Right.
Yeah, but I felt an upwelling of joy when I heard that she had won the Nobel Prize.
You know, she said to me, she was talking about, well, I wanted her to talk about herself. And she said, "Well, I'm a writer. We're all part of this tribe of writers, and we belong. We're all kind of she feels that it was like a family that she belongs to. And it's sort of like her getting the Nobel Prize, she said, when she perhaps had composed herself, was that it was an acknowledgement of writers everywhere, that she was winning this for lots of other people. So she can have that sense of generosity. Yeah. You know, it wasn't me,
right.
but all of us. This is acknowledgement of what all of us are doing.
And if it's a family of writers, she's certainly the matriarch.
Absolutely.
I heard her read somewhere within the last 10 years. She was reading from African Laughter, and I can't think where it might have been. I heard that she was reading, so I went because I wanted to see her in person. And I just loved her grandmotherliness.
And then she has a recent collection of three novellas. The title of the book is The Grandmothers, and one of the stories is called The Grandmothers. And it's about these two women who are they're getting on in life, and they're both having these sexual relationships with teenage boys.
Oh, for goodness sake.
Yes. Yeah, so I don't know whether Doris Lessing would admit this, but I think that she probably liked the idea of shocking people
a little bit. You know? I think so, yes.
Wow. She's 80 in her 80s, and she can write about older women having sex with young men, you know, taboo.
Would you speak briefly about her writing style? I found a number of references to her rather plain style and the fact that she could be lyrical when it was landscape, but that overall they thought her style was rather straightforward.
Well, she does have that label that's been attached to her that she can be didactic, that she does definitely have things that she wants to say. And you can see it in that, to go back to that first sentence in the Golden Notebook, where she says, just to make sure I have it, you know, the point is, and then she repeats that phrase, the point is that everything is cracking up. She does have points. That is the point of the book, and she just comes out and says it right away.
Mm-hmm. Am I right in remembering that the book almost cycles back in the very end?
It comes back to that.
Jake, the fellow in the Golden Notebook, she and Jake give each other the first lines of their novels.
Yes.
And so you can almost go back to the front of the book and read it all through
again. It comes around.
Or it comes around.
Beautiful.
Right. Yeah, amazing.
So I think that Doris Lessing hasn't really sufficiently been recognized as a prose stylist. I mean, I can think of like the space fiction books.
Oh, yes. We haven't talked about those at all.
You know, the planet that freezes over.
Right.
Or she has this book called Mara and Dan. It's like a post-apocalyptic epic novel. It takes place in Africa in the future, and it's like drought every place, and there's civil war and bedlam and slavery, and it has these really lush, beautiful descriptions of landscapes. And yes, there's a sturdiness about her prose, but there's also a kind of lushness about it, too. And she doesn't have any one style, just as she hasn't just gone on writing the same subject or the same kind of book.
Mm-hmm. And I find that while it looks, some of Golden Notebooks especially, when you look at the page, it looks quite dense. But she just carries you along from one sentence to another. You don't have any feeling of having to work hard to focus on what she's saying. Her narrative carries the reader, don't you think?
I think she's a really good storyteller.
I do too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You want to know what's going to happen with these characters.
That's right.
Where are they going?
Yeah.
And I think that we live in a world, I mean, people these days, the channel surf, where they're going from, they have like the TV on and they're listening to music and they're doing, we're bombarded with all kinds of different things these days.
That's
and
right.
This is a book that has several screens going on at the same time. This
That's
is
right.
the world that we live in.
Mm-hmm. That's right. It reminds me back of Fahrenheit 451 when they had the television screens surrounding them in the little boxy houses they lived in, were bombarded by that all the time. And of course that was another prophecy that's come true. That's the way we live now.
Yeah.
Yeah. Way too much input.
So, you know, it was maybe a couple of years ago, there was a sitting room publication that you may have contributed to about a book that has influenced us.
Oh, yes, the books that's changed our lives.
So the book that I wrote about was one of Doris Lessing's books. It's called Time Bites, which is a collection of essays by Doris Lessing about different writers and about books. And she has been heroic in the last 20 years or so of resurrecting forgotten writers and lost books. She's really made a point of doing that. Mm-hmm. And when I visited her in London in July, soon after I got there, she said, "Well, I'm going to a bookstore and you can come with me. I'm going to be talking about Anna Kavan." She said, "Have you ever heard of Anna Kavan?" I said, "I've never heard of Anna Kavan." Anna Kavan, she's no longer alive. She wrote about 20 books. An outstanding British writer.
Mm-hmm.
Sort of one of the many writers that Doris Lessing has adopted.
Oh. And resurrected, as it were.
Yes.
Well, good for her.
So there we were. We were in her flat, and we were going to go to the London Review bookshop. And she said, "Well, they're sending a taxi to pick me up." And she said, "There's one driver I really like, and there's two drivers. They're fascist. They're horrible. I don't like them." But she said, "There's one driver I like, and I can tell it's him because he's from Somalia, and I can see if I stand at the window and I look down, I can't see his face, but I can see his hands on the steering wheel." So she said, why don't you stand? I have to get ready to go. Why don't you stand there and look and see what if he's coming, and you'll know if it's him." And there I saw those brown hands on the steering wheel. So we were driving, and the cab driver said, he said to her, "Why is there war? Why does war still go on?" And she said, "Well, it's profitable." Yeah. So
I wanted to talk a little bit about one of the books that I like so much, one of her later books, and that's The Summer Before the Dark. Now, I think I have the right book. The protagonist, the woman, takes a job kind of on the whim at something that's very much like the United Nations. And she's working for the Committee on Hunger. I'm not doing justice to the reality of it. But And this committee meets all over the world, and they insist on meeting in five-star hotels. And they're very picky about what they have for their luncheon. And I thought she was having a wonderful time with the irony of the Committee on Starvation. And then again, in that book, there's madness in it. Madness is in so many of her books.
Absolutely. That is a theme, the cracking up. It goes back to the cracking up.
That's right, cracking up. Mm-hmm.
So Doris Lessing has, as I've said, we've talked about, she wrote these two volumes of autobiography, which stop at 1962, and she has said, "I can't go on and write a volume 3. Because in the first two volumes, she talks about real people. She uses their actual names.
I see.
And she said, I could only write about it in fiction because I lived in London in the 60s, from all through the 60s, and I saw all kinds of people going mad and cracking up. People who some of them survived, some of them didn't. Some of them committed suicide. Some of them managed to survive, and they have successful careers in London. I could never write about them." So she also took a great deal of interest in R.D. Lang.
Yes.
And got to know Lang and his therapeutic ideas. And she's like fascinated with madness.
She didn't think much of psychiatry.
Well, I would say yes and no. I mean, she's very psychologically astute.
Yes.
She does learn from Freud the importance of, like, dreams.
Oh, yes, lots of dreams.
Analyzing, interpreting
lots
dreams.
Lots of dreams, yes.
And, like, from Jung, the kind of, like, archetypes in this collective unconscious.
Yes.
So I think I would say you're probably right in that she's thought that psychology has been used in ways, for example, to control women and to keep them in their place. Mm-hmm. She's always very astute or very sharp about that. Mm-hmm. About that. So Doris Lessing, I read her books and I knew that she valued dreams and was very interested in dream work. And she's the first person that I ever told any of my own dreams to when I was just really very young. And I think that I really trusted her. Mm-hmm. That was a sign of how much I trusted her. And, well, if you tell somebody your dreams, they can make fun of you. They can do all kinds of things.
Of course.
So I had a dream that I told her about of being in a house and exploring this house that had a basement, it had an attic. I didn't know anything. I didn't know a thing about dreams. I had never read Freud. And she said, well, a house is usually taken as a, like a metaphor for yourself, the self. And she said, so this dream is probably about you. She said, what a wonderful dream. It sounds like you are exploring yourself in this dream. She started me on my way of, like, recording dreams and thinking about my dreams. And so that was another wonderful thing that I feel like I owe to her.
It's wonderful. I want to end up back in Africa. And here's another quote from Doris Lessing when she's reflecting back on the influence that Africa has had on her life. And she says, this business of writers' myth countries is far from simple. All the people I know from former dominions, colonies, or any part of the earth they grew up on before making that essential flight in and away from the periphery to the center. When the time comes for them to make the first trip home, it means stripping off new skin and offering exposed and smarting flesh to the past. And I wonder if that's what makes us writers and what makes us readers. Is that journey and the what we learn about ourselves as
well?
We
yes, journey. That also reminds me. I said to Doris Lessing once, you know, you seem to think of life as a journey, and she said, "Well, how else can one see it?"
Right. Before we go, I want to mention another Nobel Prize winner from Africa from the previous year, and that's Wangari Maathai. From Kenya, who's published her autobiography, Unbowed. And I would certainly recommend that to our listeners. It's a good read, and she's a remarkable woman. I wonder if she and Doris Lessing ever met each other. How lovely it would be to sit down and listen to the two of them talk about their lives. Two amazing women. Well, you've been listening to A Novel Idea. This is your host, Rosemary Manchester, and my guest is Jonah Raskin. Thank you so much, Jonah, author, professor, chair of communications at Sonoma State University, talking about the life and work of Doris Lessing, Nobel Prize winner for literature in 2007. Suzanne Lang produces the show. I want to remind you that every Wednesday night at 7, KRCB presents a program of literary interest. Gil Manserk does Word by Word. Catherine Hastings presents poetry in her Word Temple. And the innovative Page on Stage bunch do their thing. Pretty good for a small public radio station. The programs are archived on the website krcb.org, so you can hear us over and over whenever you want. Novel Idea will be back next month. I hope you'll join us. And remember, there's no such thing as too many books.